see you on the flip side. All right. Bye, guys.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, April 9th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest Limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. In today's episode, we'll be covering Partners in Mission upcoming food blitz this weekend, Be a Donor Month and Green Shirt Day with the Transplant Advocate Association, a celebrated Canadian artist with roots in Kingston hitting the stage with the Kingston Symphony this weekend, and more. Without further delay, let's dive in. This Saturday, April 11th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Partners in Mission Food Bank will once again host its annual food blitz at grocery stores across Kingston. Teams of volunteers will be handing out collection bags to shoppers and collecting donations. Their goal this year, to collect 25,000 pounds of food and raise $30,000. 2025 marked the fifth record-breaking year in a row for the food bank, with over 22,000 household visits and helping nearly 10,000 people. And already, 2026 is on track to exceed those numbers. Partners in Mission Executive Director Dan Irwin shared with CFRC what he's seeing in the community heading into this year's food blitz.
We had a record year in 2025. It was our fifth record year in a row. We helped 1 in 17 people in Kingston and Loyalist Township with food. That is a shocking number. And the first 3 months of this year, our household visits are up 22.6%, which is unbelievable.
Spring and summer are typically slower months for donations, making this campaign critical for the months ahead.
Yeah, our timing with our event this spring is to help, number one, remind everyone that there are neighbors in need in the community and hunger is 365 days a year. And two, we're trying to restock and build our reserves, I guess we'll call it, as we come into the slower donation months.
I was wondering if you could expand a bit upon that, about what the summer looks like, and again, what hitting this goal means for the next few months.
Certainly. Over the summer, we see very few donations. Everyone's busy with their summer lives, and as we know in Canada, we don't get a lot of summer, so we want to enjoy that as much as possible. Unfortunately, the donations drop. So what we need is this lift in the spring to help stock our shelves, give us more money so that we're able to buy what we don't get and really just help us keep going through the summer.
This will also be the first year Partners in Mission is in their new larger space for this campaign, a move Irwin says happened at the right time.
We moved in our new space in April of 2025, and it's been amazing. Our clients love it. Our volunteers love it. It's just a much more dignified space and experience. That, with the growth, was good timing because we're able to continue to keep up to this growth. Our old space, we would not be able to manage these high of numbers on a daily basis. So it was good timing to move, and the space enables us to store more food. And with the money we get, we can also buy larger volumes and save those deals.
But even with that expansion, the bigger picture remains. Demand is climbing, an increasing concern not only for this campaign, but for the city as a whole. As you mentioned earlier, visits are nearly 23% higher than this time last year. You've already had five record-breaking years in a row. And you've said many times the community is always very generous in this campaign. But do you worry we're kind of nearing a limit in terms of keeping up with need?
I'm really worried about that. At what point will there be too many people using our services versus those who can afford to donate? And when we tip that balance, it's going to be ugly.
For now, Partners in Mission is counting on the community to step up once again. What items are you most in need of right now?
We're always looking for canned meat and canned fish, peanut butter or nut butter type replacements. Stews and chunky soups are very important. Boxes of breakfast cereal. And always we're in need of baby food and the larger size diapers, the 3, 4, 5s, and wipes, please.
And how can folks contribute?
We'll be at 8 grocery stores on Saturday the 11th from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. Tanya's, No Frills, Andrew's, No Frills, Loblaws, both Loblaws, Freshco, Food Basics on Highway 15, Food Basics on Princess Street, and Food Basics at Gardner's Road, RioCan. If you're shopping that day, you can donate money or food there. Or if you're not able to make it out on Saturday, if you can go to kingstonfoodbank.ca and you'll see donate in the upper right-hand button, and you can click on the Food Blitz and make a donation for that.
Fantastic. And I was wondering if you could, just to finish us off, give us just a few words of encouragement for folks who are considering donating this weekend or who are just out and about this weekend, you know, what this event kind of means for the community, both for those donating and for those receiving.
Every donation counts, whether it's small or large. It all adds together. We do not receive government funding. We rely on our community to support our neighbors in need. So every donation helps, and our volunteers are out there. They want to have some fun. They want to collect some money, and they want to make a difference. So they'd love to see your smiling face. And if you can't make a donation, just wish them a good day, and they will be able to move on and help the next person who wants to make a donation. And thank you so much for everyone for their help this weekend, whether you're a donor or a volunteer. It's hugely important for us to help our neighbors in need.
In front of City Hall on Tuesday, a green flag was raised, marking more than a moment of recognition, but a call to action. Members of the Transplant Advocate Association gathered to mark Green Shirt Day and Be a Donor Month with a flag raising and proclamation ceremony. The organization works year-round to raise awareness about the urgent need for organ and tissue donation, and as a support network for transplant recipients, donors, and their loved ones throughout the region. April is a particularly meaningful time for the group. Green Shirt Day, observed April 7th across Canada, honors Logan Boulay, the young hockey player whose decision to become an organ donor saved 6 lives after he and several of his teammates died in the tragic 2018 Humboldt Broncos bus crash. Logan's story encouraged more than 150,000 Canadians to register as organ donors, more than ever before, arising from just one event. April is also Be a Donor Month, celebrated annually to bring awareness to the need for organ and tissue donation in Ontario and to inspire people who are not currently registered to do so. Mayor Brian Patterson was present to read the official proclamation for Green Shirt Day and Be a Donor Month in the City of Kingston.
I, Mayor Brian Patterson, on behalf of Kingston City Council, hereby proclaim the month of April to be a Donor Month and April 7th, 2026 as Green Shirt Day in the City of Kingston, and I hereby encourage all Kingstonians to be organ donors in their community. Thank you very much.
This year's Be a Donor Month comes as over 1,700 Ontarians are currently waiting for life-saving organ transplants. And every 3 days, someone dies waiting. Thousands more are waiting for life-restoring tissue transplants. Just one organ donor can save up to 8 lives and enhance the lives of up to 75 others through tissue donation. The Trillium Gift of Life Network reports that while more than 90% of eligible Ontarians indicate that they're in favor of organ donation, only 35% are registered to be organ donors. At the ceremony, TAA members, including President Simon Labette, shared their stories and encouraged others to ensure they're registered.
My wife, Celine Labette, who you will hear about more from Teresa later today, had a double lung transplant in 2005 and had 21 years of extra life because of one donor's decision. And if today does anything, it reminds us all of the power we each have to support, to connect, to say yes to something that can truly change lives. Please register as a donor, just like Logan Boulay did. Thank you very much.
Natalie Witten with Kingston Health Sciences Center's Kidney Transplant Program also spoke to the impact of donation.
Spreading the word and talking about organ donation and transplant with your families and friends truly does make a difference. And we're lucky enough to be able to be witness to that in every day at work. So thank you so much.
For those gathered, the ceremony was a reminder that one decision can save many lives. Ontarians can register online by visiting beadonor.ca or in person at any Service Ontario Centre when renewing their license or health card. Before we get into more local news this evening, let's take a look at your weather and traffic report for the rest of the week with CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Thursday, April 9th. We're back to that lovely spring weather. Daytime high of 13 degrees in the forecast with just a 25% chance of precipitation. We're going to see mostly cloudy conditions, and there will be a decent amount of wind blowing, but still much preferable to what we had. Friday, April 10th, daytime high of 10 degrees with a 65% chance of precipitation, feeling closer to 6 degrees because of the rain. Saturday, April 11th, this is more like it, 14 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. It's going to be a gorgeous spring day. And that's going to follow up into Sunday, March 12th, another double-digit day, 13 with a mostly sunny condition. And starting off next week, Monday, April 13th, we've got a 13-degree day with lots of sun in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week, and just bear in mind, winter overnight street parking restrictions have been lifted as of April 1st. We begin with two long-term road closures. Berry Street to Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. We have some short-term road closures as well, including Wright Crescent at Palace Road, which is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. There is a minimal traffic disruption on Bath Road to Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing intersection pedestrian signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. They are installing these signals at the following intersections: Bath Road at Lafleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Safe driving, everybody.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. A celebrated Canadian artist with roots in Kingston is returning to the stage this weekend. Three-time Juno-nominated singer-songwriter Jill Barber joins the Kingston Symphony for Under Paris Skies, a concert of timeless French classics, Saturday, April 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Kingston Grand Theatre. Known for her blend of folk, jazz, and chanson, Barber will perform iconic songs like La Vie en Rose and La Mer, transporting audiences into the heart of Paris. While she hails from Mississauga, Ontario, and is now based in Vancouver, Barber graduated from Queen's University in 2002 and began her early music career performing in local venues. I spoke with Jill Barber about the show and what it means to return to the city where it all began. Well, to start us off, you studied at Queen's University. How does it feel to be returning to Kingston to perform at this part in your career?
It feels incredible. I had such a great experience attending Queen's and living in Kingston, and it means so much to me to be returning in this context, to be presenting this show, to be collaborating with the Kingston Symphony, to play the Grand Theatre where I saw so many shows as a student. I have so much affection and so many happy memories of my time in Kingston. So it really feels like a homecoming of sorts.
Mm-hmm. And was that kind of your initial reaction when you got this request from the Symphony to come in?
Yes, it was absolutely top of my wish list to get to do this with the Kingston Symphony. I've created this show along with musical director Drew Jureka and a conductor Lucas Walden, and we've put this package together, and we've been approaching symphonies across the country, and so we're doing a handful of different shows with different symphonies, but the Kingston one was definitely, to use a French term, like in coup de cœur, like it was a special one for me. It is a special one for me. So I was so pleased when they signed on.
Awesome. Well, we're excited to have you back. Getting into the show, tell us a bit about this program. What can audiences expect from Under Paris Skies?
Absolutely. So for the last, I'd say, decade or so, I've been really preoccupied, maybe a little bit obsessed with old French music. I just love the way it makes me feel, kind of romantic, and it transports me to another place, another time. It's very sensual. It's very beautiful. It's very dramatic, this French material, these old French songs, the most celebrated kind of grand chanson. And so I've recorded a couple of albums of my favorite songs. And this is the live version that we're presenting. But it's totally over the top with the addition of the symphony orchestras. So it's very musically rich, very evocative. And the whole hope and goal of these shows is that you can come in, sit in your seat, sit back and relax, and really be swept away to another time and place. You can close your eyes, and the idea is that it's a very cheap trip to Paris, and you get all of the benefits, all of the romance, and all of the kind of dreamy romanticism of Paris from the comfort of your seat, wherever you happen to be. So it's very, we're trying to transport people and inspire and really take people on a trip.
You kind of got into it there, but how does performing these songs with the full symphony kind of change the experience, both for you as a performer and for the audience?
It's unbelievable from my perspective. There's something so classic and so powerful about a symphony orchestra, and each musician that in the orchestra that has reached this level has truly mastered their instrument and has truly dedicated so many hours and so much passion and dedication to their playing, that when they all come together, it's just, it's magical. It's absolutely magical and powerful. And to be up there singing alongside a symphony orchestra for me is just, it's like the Mount Everest of performing experiences, truly. And hopefully from the audience point of view, they can just, you know, have the music wash over them and be really swept away by it too. So it's really special for me. I mean, it's also so funny for me because I think back to my time at Queen's, you know, that's really where I started performing in front of people. When I was in first year, second year university, I was playing the open mic nights and the coffee houses. And then I formed a band and I was playing at pubs around Kingston. So for me as a singer-songwriter, I feel like the whole experience of performing with a symphony orchestra has totally elevated my abilities to deliver a performance. And so I'm just kind of riding high on what the symphony orchestra is doing. And I'm also really, like, I've tapped into my inner diva for these shows. So I'm doing a lot of costume changes, and I'm, like, really trying to inhabit the character and the songs as well. There's just something about the lushness of an orchestra that kind of makes me feel like I'm not quite myself. I'm like some movie version of myself or something. So it's like it's as if it's a soundtrack that's kind of lifting up my performance.
I was wondering what drew you to French chanson in particular, both in the context of your career and as you were putting this show together. What about that specific genre really drew you in?
So I'm an Anglophone. I didn't grow up in a French household. I did go to French immersion when I was a child, but I quit after grade 6. I actually begged my parents to let me out of French. I didn't like it at the time. I found it challenging. And I remember saying to my parents, I just want to read and write in English. That's my language. French doesn't speak to me. And it was only as an adult and as a touring musician where I started to play more in Quebec. And there was one fateful evening in Montreal. I was performing at the Montreal Jazz Festival, and I really wanted to address my audience in French, but was very insecure about my French skills. So a friend of mine translated one of my songs into French for me to perform live that night. And there was just something about getting my mouth around my own words, but a French version of them. It felt like I was tapping into like a whole other side of myself as an artist, as a performer, or just even as a person. It's as if I have this like old French soul that had been kind of dormant, just that was really awakened that night. And so I was so inspired after that evening, especially given the audience's reaction. They were so appreciative of me singing in French. I was so inspired that I actually enrolled myself in a French school for adults in the south of France. And I went for a month. And then the next year, I went back for another month. And anyway, I just completely immersed myself in the French language and in the French culture and in all the old French music. And so I just kind of, I sort of just fell in love with the way it made me feel. It was like, even if I didn't understand every word, I could feel the emotion, because I feel like the French, you know, a singer like Edith Piaf, like she sings so passionately and the words just roll off of her tongue in such a visceral, sensual way. I'm really attracted to that. And so I kind of feel like I'm an Anglophone, but I have this French alter ego, and I really like to spend time with her because she's a lot of fun. And so that was the whole motivation for recording French songs on my own and for creating this show that could hopefully share some of that feeling of putting on rose-colored glasses, you know, with my audience. It's a really nice feeling to escape this time and this place and all of the challenges of the day-to-day and just allow yourself to feel a little more romantic about the whole world.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you have a favorite song or a song that's very special to you on this program?
I would say it's a tough call because I dearly love so many of these songs, and there's lots of different flavors. There's one that I love to sing called Padam Padam, because it's one of Edith Piaf's most famous songs, and it's a song about a woman kind of going mad. And there's something very liberating about kind of inhabiting that mad woman character and kind of going a little crazy on stage. And as, you know, especially with the symphony behind me, kind of creating the soundtrack for a kind of a crazed mind. That's very, very fun to perform. But there's another song called Les Feuilles Mortes, which is the French version of the great jazz standard Autumn Leaves, which is just a heartbreakingly beautiful song about lost love. I love performing that one. And then I also do, in the whole program, I do one original song, one song that I wrote. And it's just one quiet moment where the symphony takes a break. And it's a brand new song of mine called Box of Wishes that I'm really proud of. And it means a lot to me. So it's really nice to perform that original song in this program as well.
Awesome. And one more question about Kingston as you're returning here, probably for the first time in quite a while. Are there any specific locations that you're excited to revisit and see again?
Yes. Well, I have a reservation to go for brunch at Chez Piggy, which is a restaurant that I worked at myself. I worked mostly in the bakery at Pan Chancho. I was a dishwasher and when I was a student, and my shift started at, I think it started at 5 or 6 p.m., and went till about 11 p.m. or midnight. And so I have a lot of memories of late nights leaving the bakery and walking home to my student home, my student housing, where I had four other roommates. And I would bring home the bread to my roommates that wasn't sold that day. And myself and my other four roommates, we all lived on University Avenue. We would feast on the baguettes that didn't sell. And that's the flavor of that time in my life when I was in my early 20s and had my whole life ahead of me. I was definitely writing a lot of songs at that time as a kind of a newish singer-songwriter. So anyway, I always have to go back to Pan Chancho or Chez Piggy when I'm in Kingston, because it's delicious, and it's delicious to taste the nostalgia of those places for me. So they're total institutions for me, and I have a real personal connection. So I will be having brunch the morning after at Chez Piggy.
Awesome. And both were lifelong fans and people new to this genre. What do you hope folks take away from the night?
I mean, I think it's a perfect occasion to get a little dressed up and have an evening out that feels a little different, a little more elevated, you know, get a little culture, support your symphony orchestra, and feel the power of being kind of swept away by all of that incredible musicianship. And as for me, I really feel like my job as the guest singer is also kind of like to host everybody and to make everybody feel cared for. And so even though a lot of what I'm singing is in French, I contextualize all the songs and tell little stories about what I've learned about them. And I do that in English. So I don't think anyone should feel intimidated if they don't speak French. I will be kind of like a tour guide, in a sense, walking folks through the repertoire and hopefully just entertaining you. I mean, really, that's my goal, is to entertain and inspire and to have people leave feeling a little lighter than when they arrived.
That was Jill Barber performing with the Kingston Symphony this Saturday, April 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Kingston Grand Theater. For tickets and more information, you can visit the Kingston Symphony website or call the Grand Theater box office at 613-530-2050. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
On CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m., you'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephoned interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
The Office of VP Research offers undergraduate students meaningful opportunities to engage in discovery-based learning and to develop research and presentation skills through their Undergraduate Student Summer Research Fellowship and the Undergraduate Student Research Award. Do you self-identify as a Black or Indigenous person? There are allocated funds through the USRA to help address the disproportionate underfunding of Black and Indigenous scholars at the undergraduate level. All projects are paid full-time work under the guidance of a faculty researcher and run from May through August. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department supervisor today. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department or supervisor today. Access the website to learn more, queensu.ca/VPR/resources/undergraduate. For general inquiries, contact Tracy Allen at allent@queensu.ca.
Are you between 14 and 30 years old and interested in organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen. You could receive $850 to create your activity, and your partnering organization could get $150 to support it. Bring your idea to life. Visit programvif.ca and apply today.
Music doesn't need a visa. 有些声音不用翻译也能听懂。No genre limits, Kokyomonai. I'm your host, Haitong Ni. Tune in Thursday morning in 10 a.m. on CFRC. This is from CN to CA.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
That's why.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. These are one of the final three episodes that we're doing with you guys. It's been quite a wild ride, but we are not slowing down. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about today, a lot of stuff going on in the NHL. We're gonna tackle some new sports today, and then we've got some golf news as well. So this is going to be quite the episode. I'm joined by Sam Schoenfeld today. Sam, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing phenomenally well. Thanks again for starting the whole show. Little does everyone know, Adam went through no small ordeal today to make this happen. He had to ensure that my voice wasn't appearing on the speaker of another room, the radio station. It was a whole fiasco, but thanks to his high IQ, we are now broadcasting to you, not live, but in conjunction and coordination, which is no small feat.
I think it's less my high IQ and more my random button mashing on the soundboard here. But yes, we did have quite the rough start to the show, but here we are now, all good to go. And actually, Sam, I think you were off the call, but as soon as I stopped the call, the microphone dropped off of the metal stand thing here, and just onto my, and I'm like, can more stuff be going wrong right now? But luckily we were able to get going and we're ready to talk about some sports. Just to do a quick, I know we talked a lot about it last week. We talked about the playoff race in the NHL a lot last week, so we're not going to focus on that as much today. But there is important to kind of show some trends happening. The Philadelphia Flyers are on a really hot run right now. They've won three in a row and are actually tied with the Red Wings and the Senators now with 86 points. They're dangerous. They're looking pretty good. I know we've talked about how crazy this East playoff race is, but I did not think a new team would be joining the fold this late into the season. But it really goes to show that if you get hot at the right time, you can really do anything. In the West, Edmonton is playing pretty good now. They've now won three in a row. They're trying to push Anaheim out of that top spot in the Pacific. So even without Draisaitl, Edmonton is doing okay. And Winnipeg is looking like a team that might be able to put some stuff together and get back into that last wild card spot. Right now they're sitting 3 points out. So I know a couple episodes ago we were talking about how much the Canadian teams weren't really being well represented, but here's Winnipeg kind of making a push. And then if Ottawa sneaks in too, we could have 14 Canadian teams in the playoffs again. So definitely would be a good thing to see. Sam, anything from this week of hockey that caught your eye?
Well, I think you were probably getting to it, but as the great and wise minds in Toronto often do, they have fired their general manager with 8 games left in the regular season. Obviously, you and I are quite pleased to see Toronto crumble and fall. I will say this is a bit bizarre to cheer for a Canadian team to do badly, but I don't even know if Toronto counts as Canadian anymore because all their fans sprout like dandelion all over the world and all you want to do is rip them out of the ground. although one has to ask, Adam, the most important question, who in their right mind fires a GM with 8 games left in a season? Why not let them finish it out?
And it was such a weird time for them to fire Brad Treveling because Austin Matthews had that season-ending injury a couple weeks ago against the Anaheim Ducks. Radko Gudas took him out. And this was like the rematch between that. Like Anaheim-Toronto, that was the game that was happening the day that he got fired. Like before the game was started, they announced the firing of him. And like, just a weird like cycle of events to like why would you fire your coach or your manager, general manager, right before probably what's the biggest game of the season for the Leafs, because they have nothing else to play for. Like, I know that people are saying, oh, you know, it could be a distraction to the team. I'm like, distraction from what? Losing? Like, maybe that would be a good distraction to have. But yeah, no, just a strange thing to do. I don't understand why it couldn't have waited or why they didn't do it earlier, because Toronto has not been in it for quite some time. And I also don't really see the harm in letting him run out the season and then making an off-season change for a new general manager. Very odd. You got to wonder if it's like some kind of external pressure from ownership. There was a news conference today for the owner of MLSC, or the CEO of MLSC, so that's the ownership group that owns the Maple Leafs. And he was asked all of these questions about the Leafs, and the guy's name is Pelly. And they were asking him about the team, and he said that he has nothing to do with this team, really. He doesn't really know too much about the functions, the daily functions of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And there were a couple times where he mispronounced top prospects' names and players on the Leafs' names that you should probably know if you're going to be the owner of the team. And now he's stepping in as kind of the guy for the rest of the season until they hire someone else. So that's Keith Pelly. And he claimed that they're not going to tank. So I don't really know what that means, since they were sellers at the trade deadline and traded good players. That sounds like tanking to me. But yeah, just kind of a train wreck going on in Toronto right now. And I can't help to say, but I'm like beaming right now. I don't think I've smiled this wide in a couple weeks.
I was about to say, it's raining and pouring where I am right now. And yeah, yet through the dark clouds, I see a glowing blue light that says Leafs suck. And it's never been truer. I will say, what I do find kind of funny, though, is that it seems like this was a premeditated firing of sorts, mm-hmm. in that Toronto got rid of so many good players. I'm only surprised that they didn't get rid of other good players. And frankly, though, I don't think that this is the GM being fired is actually pressure from management or from, you know, from ownership. I actually don't.
Okay.
I think my guess is that it's from the players. Now, there's no one said anything about that. There's no rumors about it. But if I had to guess, guys like Tavares probably went up and said, this guy's got to go. Because if I was a player on the team, I'd feel a little bit betrayed. I don't think this season was supposed to be a bad year for Toronto.
No.
I feel like a lot of guys in the Maple Leafs think that Marner should have stayed. And I think Marner wanted to leave. But I don't know that the Leafs really cared to make him stay. And frankly, they just let him walk away. And that's a pretty big betrayal, because the Leafs invested so much time and strategy in Marner and pushed so many guys to the side to let Marner shine. And then what? They didn't even try and protect him when the time came. Just let him walk the plank, go to Vegas. I don't know. I just think that reflects poorly on management. And in turn, it makes the players distrust everyone around them.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm sure at the end of the day, ownership decides who's there and who's not. So ultimately, it came down to them. Obviously, they wanted him gone if they fired him to some degree. The question is to what degree. I don't think, maybe this initiative came from them. It's fully possible. I just have a theory about it. Although I will say, I don't really know who would be a good fit to fix Toronto. Like, I mean, there's been a lot of great GMs in the NHL, and there's a lot of great GMs in the NHL right now. But yeah. Are there any superhumans or any gods out there who can resurrect Satan from hell?
Like, I don't.
This is not an easy task. It's the worst hockey team in the history of the world with the worst fan base and the best bad luck of anyone I've ever seen, of any team I've ever seen. It seems like an impossible task. So I wouldn't even want to be Toronto's GM if I was someone who was floated as a name.
Yeah,
I don't know how Toronto's going to come out of this one. Maybe this Keith guy's going to stay and ruin the team even more. And by the way, on the topic of tanking, thank you for bringing that up, Adam.
Yeah,
they're 100% going to tank everything.
Oh,
I don't see why they would do anything short of tanking. it's I mean, one, they were going to tank no matter what because it's Toronto. Toronto tends to tank even if they're not trying to tank. But I mean, like, now it's just going to be grossly intentional, which is fine, whatever, let it be, so be it. Worse things have happened before. But yeah. I do think that there should be a penalty in the NHL for intentionally tanking, which there will be.
I think they're at the point right now, like, with 8 games to go, like, you can't really adjust your points standings too much. Like, I guess they could fall into the top 5 and get that top 5 pick, because then I don't think Boston gets that pick. So they could do that. But, I mean, at the same time, like, it's pretty clear that this team is in tank mode. Like, they're not in the win mode, so... Yeah, I completely agree with you there.
But anyways, let's talk about Max Domi getting some revenge for his captain, though.
Absolutely.
Not that I want to talk about Toronto too much, but I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, no. So Radko Gudas, as I was mentioning before, kind of public enemy number one in Toronto after the hit to end Austin Matthews' season. Off the first puck drop, Domi and Gudas go at it, and Domi rocked Gudas pretty hard. Like, he was throwing some punches. I haven't seen that Max Domi in a long time. But I mean, I also saw that it kind of looked like Gudas was holding back a little bit. I don't know what you think, Sam, but Gudas didn't really land a punch the whole time. I don't think Gudas is a poor fighter, so I found that surprising. But I also don't think Max Domi is an amazing fighter. But I don't know. That was just my take. I thought Gudas held back a little bit. What did you see from that?
Well, I know Gudas has done himself get punched. Let's not whack around the bush. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you. You fully allow that to happen, but rightfully so. I think he understood that was sort of one of the unspoken laws of hockey.
Yeah.
So I mean, I don't know. I think that worked out as well as possible. Max Domi got a couple good punches, and Gudas probably got a little bit hurt from it. And then for the rest of the game, it wasn't really an issue. And it got made Toronto feel a little bit better about themselves, probably. Probably. Well, I guess it was still a bit of an issue. But it could have been a big issue the whole game, is my point.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole game could have been about running Gudas through the boards, and it wasn't.
No.
And I think that's good in general. It's just better. And similarly, I will say this to Toronto, good for them. They saw what happens when a good player gets taken down in a dirty manner, and they didn't want to lower themselves to that level, and they didn't.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I mean, I think that fighting is one of the most respectable ways to show what the law of the ice is and what rules are to be followed and which rules aren't to be followed, and they enforce it the only proper way that I know.
Yeah, no, it was a good tilt. And honestly, the game was pretty exciting too. Like for a nothing burger of a game, I guess, like, Anaheim really needs points, I guess. Not too bad. They're pretty comfortable in their playoff spot, but Toronto was able to sneak out the win. I think it went to either overtime or shootout, and Anaheim lost. So I guess Toronto does get the last laugh a little bit there. But yeah, no, it was a good game. Kind of nice to see, kind of some excitement. I feel like the playoff race gets really exciting for some teams, and then other teams that are down in the dumps kind of get left behind. I mean, I should know. I've watched the Montreal Canadiens the last few years be at the bottom of the barrel, and it can get boring for those kinds of fans at the end of the season when you're playing teams that are trying to vie for a playoff spot. So yeah, no, it was good to see. Speaking of other hockey news, in like other weird firing situations, the Vegas Golden Knights fired Bruce Cassidy and hired John Tortorella with 8 games left to go in the season. Now, I don't know about you, Sam, but I've never seen a coach get fired this late into a season, especially a coach on a team currently in the playoffs. Now, Vegas has like been kind of... not even kind of bad. They've been bad this year. Like, they have like so many overtime losses, and they're really getting carried by those overtime losses. They have more total losses than wins. Like what's going on here? Have you seen anything like this before?
Yeah. So I don't know if you'll recall, but some 5, maybe 6 years ago, maybe longer than that now, since we're 2026, must have been 8 or 9 years. I'm really aging myself there. Ottawa fired whoever was coaching at the time. Something like that wasn't 8 games before the playoffs, but something like 25 or 30. Anyways, did not work out at all.
Yeah.
I think Tortorella has a better proof of concept, but I don't think it's going to do Vegas well. It's just really weird, though. I don't really understand the strategy behind firing a coach at this stage in the game. I also don't think the Vegas Golden Knights have a team that will respond positively to Tortorella's negativity. I'm sure you've seen the memes. I'm sure everyone's seen the memes of Mitch Marner crying and wanting to leave Vegas now that Tortorella's there.
I have seen those, yeah.
but on a very real level.
Yeah.
What does Marner owe to Vegas? He can go wherever he wants.
No, exactly.
I'm sure he'll leave if he wants to leave, and Tortorella will be the guy to make him go if he's really as evil as people say. So actually, funny story, John Scott has a whole chapter in his biography about how much he hates Tortorella. That's how much players either hate or love towards. Apparently, he's just, you know, it's you either hate him or you love him. I think most people hate him, though.
Yeah.
But he gets the job done, usually.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's just really bizarre. I do think this is really bad for Vegas, though. And whoever decided to hire Tortorella clearly does not understand the dynamics of hockey in a locker room. So that's all I can really say about it. I don't know if you have any different thoughts than I do.
No, I was going to ask that. Like, what? I'm sure you probably have. I don't know if you have or not experienced a coaching change midseason on any of your teams at any kind of sports.
A few times.
Like, what's that like? That's got to be a big change because that's your whole different coaches have different strategies when it comes to practice and stuff like that. So eight games before the playoffs, eight games before the most important games of the season, how big of a change will this be?
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't really speak to any specifics because I don't want to, air any bad blood that still exists because I'm sure it still does, but...
Fair enough.
I had one coach get fired midway through the season, and... Anyways, in that particular situation, I think the role was sort of usurped by the assistant coaches.
Mm.
But anyways, it does have a bad impact, though. I mean, people did not like the first coach anyways, so it wasn't a huge problem, right? Like, nothing really changed too much.
Right.
But they certainly didn't trust the other new coaches. And also, I mean, as much as you don't, maybe, so let's say everyone on Vegas hated the old coaching. I'm going to call it a regime because with a coach comes a certain style of play, a certain style of practice, a certain set of systems. Let's suppose that everyone on Vegas really didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how much they didn't like it, they bought into it to some degree. They had to implement it on the ice.
Yeah.
Tortorella is going to come in and uproot everything they've been trying to work on the whole year to implement his regime. And that's fine. That's what coaches do. But that's not going to happen overnight. And people aren't going to trust the system. They're not familiar with it. It's just not going to work out. They're just set to lose games. I've just never seen such a bad decision.
Yeah, it feels I know what you mean.
It's just
a surprising decision. I don't even know where that comes from, the motivation. Obviously, I understand Cassidy, maybe deserves to get fired at the end of the season. But right before the playoffs, it's just something it's unheard of. I've never heard of anything like this, so I was so surprised to see the news. I felt like the coaching changes were kind of done for the year until the off season, so definitely caught me by surprise. But I guess only time will tell again because Vegas is right there in the middle of a playoff race right now. I personally think they will get in. I think they've got a nice roster. I think they've got a good team. Maybe that is what the management was seeing, is that they've got the players and the coach is holding them back. Maybe we'll see a more relaxed kind of Torts because, he's only got 8 games to work with before the playoffs with these guys. He doesn't really have too much time to be a doo-doo head, right? So, I mean, I guess we'll only see how well this works out for him.
I will say, if I just may add one more thing, from Torts' point of view, I have no idea why he said yes to this.
Doesn't
make any sense.
Would you take I'm pretty sure I would take a coaching gig for a team that's already in the playoffs. How much work do you have to do to do that?
Just think of what happens if everything goes to hell and they do terribly. That's his reputation tarnished. I think Torts prides himself on the fact that he turns teams around for being a jackass. There's no time to turn this team around right now. It's either you keep building on what's being built or you run them into the ground.
But see, that's the thing, is I think that everyone kind of realizes that there's no time to turn this team around, so he's kind of going to get a pass on this one, because there's no high expectations.
It's very low reward, very high cost.
That's
if
fair.
If he ruins this team, his legacy will be tarnished somewhat.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like he does not care too much about his legacy, if people like him or not kind of level. But
no, I'm talking about a success level. In terms
that's fair enough. Torts hasn't won a cup, has he?
No, I can't remember. I don't think so.
I don't know.
I'd be shocked.
Off the top of
my head. I think Lord Stanley's avoiding him from his grave.
I was gonna say he doesn't strike
and for
me.
That
as
matter,
a...
for that matter, Lady Bing's avoiding him too.
Oh yeah.
Not that that's something he could ever win, but I'm sure if Lady Bing was aware of what was going on right now, she'd probably protest by throwing a tissue or two on the ice.
Oh, Tortorella won a cup in 2004 with the Tampa Bay Lightning.
When Marty carried him there, the greatest coach in the NHL.
That's
speaking
what I'm
of
saying.
Guys who probably shouldn't have been good coaches but ended up being amazing, I don't think there was any indication that Marty would be a great professional coach without any professional coaching experience.
I mean, is it crazy to say that if you are just a level-headed hockey, smart hockey player, like you can maybe have a good coaching career? Like, I feel like that's not crazy to say. Like I know he hadn't really done anything beforehand of any significance when it comes to coaching, but I mean, I've been amazed with how he can motivate and like create a good environment for this team. Like, this team genuinely looks like they love to play together.
Yeah, I mean, I think he gets it. Look, this is the thing people forget about Marty. This guy from U Sports walked on to the Calgary Flames from U Sports.
That's
he understands
crazy.
He understands what it's like to be the worst and to be the best.
Yeah.
So that's not something that every coach has. Most coaches either understand what it was like to be the best or to be the worst.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Do they understand both?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. He's a good balance. Anyways, moving over to some other sports today, we got to talk about the Toronto Blue Jays starting their season. They made it to the World Series last year, sadly lost in Game 7 to the Dodgers in heartbreaking fashion, but they're back. They're looking better than ever. They do have a lot of injuries on the pitching rotation to start this season, but they started off the season with a 3-game sweep of the Athletics, and now they're playing the Rockies. They dropped the first game yesterday. But yeah, the Blue Jays, they're Sam, do you have any expectations for the Jays? Do you think they'll be able to get back, or was that kind of a fluky run last year?
Well, I mean, the roster is still relatively the same. Not much has changed. I think they can do it. It's not gonna be easy. I don't know. The thing is, I mean, I'm not a baseball expert by any stretch of the imagination.
No,
so part of me wonders how much of their success was luck per se mixed with hard work. I mean, look, it wasn't just luck. They worked hard and they're a talented team, but no two seasons are the same. So I think it's possible. I just don't think it'll come as easily as it did last year. I feel like they made their way there pretty efficiently last year.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, they were one of the favorites going into the playoffs. At the beginning of the season, they definitely weren't. I think the expectations are definitely there this year, so I wouldn't be surprised if they feel a little more pressure, and that might make things a little more jittery. But again, I think it's the case with all these sports. Just try to stay healthy. Like, if you have a healthy team, like, you'll be able to put together at least your best effort. And especially with baseball, with that grueling 162 game season, it's very important that you try to stay as healthy as possible. So they're already kind of hurt in that department. But yeah, we will only be able to see such a long season. We won't be here to cover the World Series if they do eventually get back next year. But it was fun to cover the Jays during that run. Speaking of Masters, or speaking of championships, I guess we can talk about Tiger Woods, the all-time Masters champion. Had a quite the interesting weekend. It felt like I hopped into a time machine and went back to the early 2000s because he flipped his car and got arrested for a DUI. And this is not the first time that this has happened to Tiger Woods. But this was a funny story because Tiger was trying to play the Masters in a couple weeks. So he was gearing up. That's what everyone was talking about. He had done all these like TV interviews talking about it. Really seemed to have turned the other, turned a new leaf and was back on the way of being a good citizen. But this kind of goes and maybe changes a lot of people's minds about that. Sam, did you see the article about Tiger and his car crash?
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess it's public news, so we can talk about it, but
yeah.
It seems like he was pretty cooperative, but he basically just refused to pee into a cup. But he passed the breathalyzer test, so whatever it wasn't alcohol.
Yeah, they said they found two pills that are some kind of opioids, so they think that it might be like impaired driving off the opioids. So apparently, yeah,
the question too is like opioids are painkillers fundamentally.
Yeah.
So the question too is then like, well, was this prescribed or is he just, you know, getting stuff illegally, which is potentially what happened.
Yeah. No, it will be interesting to see what happens with this. I mean, I don't think he suffered any serious injuries in this car crash. But like this really puts his master's participation at risk. I mean,
well, he might just be in jail.
So. Exactly. He might just be in jail. So, I mean, like, even if he is out, I don't think that the odds of him playing in this year's Masters are going to be very, very good.
No, but one really important thing that people don't talk about enough, and this part really gets to me because it's probably the most important thing that's come out of this. If you observe the mugshot that he recently took and the one that he took from when he first got arrested
for
drinking and driving, you will notice that his forehead was much larger in the past than it is today. Yet his hairline is receding right now. It seems as though his eyes went up. So the question that it raises is this. Does playing golf for a long time shrink your forehead?
Or now, did they clone Tiger Woods?
So, yeah, this may not even be Tiger who drove. And it's a really important question. Like, all these scientists back in the late 1800s, early 1900s were measuring people's skulls and stuff for genetic reasons, trying to prove that, you know, like, you're born in this part of the world, your brain was this size, whatever, whatever. It actually means nothing. What we've learned is that golf is the greatest predictor of skull size and brain size. My theory is that Tiger Woods' brain has expanded so much that his forehead has had to shrink, so that the outward growth could be consumed by his nose and eyeballs sticking out further.
And this outward growth of his brain has caused him to drive impaired.
For the second time. I know. And people will say this is a crazy theory. And to them I say, prove me that I am wrong.
Well, if anyone wants to call CFRC and let them know the scientific evidence to break down Sam's argument, feel free. We'd love to talk about it on our show next week. But Sam, I think you might have you might be onto nothing here. But yeah, I don't know where your mind goes, Sam. You're quite the creative thinker. We are going to cover two more things before we go. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but we were talking about the World Cup a couple episodes back and Canada having to play Italy because Italy's going to walk through the World Cup qualification stage. And I'm happy to report we won't have to play Italy. It will be Bosnia and Herzegovina instead, as they knocked off the Italians in penalties. So Italy misses out on the World Cup again. Sam, is this the downfall of Italian soccer? Do they need to pack it up and just embrace baseball after their impressive World Baseball Classic performance?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what Italy's got to do. They got to get back on the penne or something, because obviously they stopped eating the pasta they were eating before. I don't really know what's happening to Italy's soccer. Ever since Balotelli, Italy has been like the Roman Empire. It's crumbled. They can't play soccer anymore. I actually don't really know how to fix the problem, though, because it's not like they have bad players.
No.
It's just really weird. It's kind of like Canada not winning a gold medal for 50 years, though. The only difference is that, you know, there was no Olympics to play in at the highest professional level. But still, I mean, Italy has no business losing to Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Especially in the most important game of the year. Like, most important game for this group of guys. Yeah. And just to, like, not be able to pull through is... It's surprising because Italy is still ranked quite high in the world soccer rankings, but that has not translated into World Cup success. Let alone success attendance. It hasn't even translated into. So
yeah, and also just for Canada, this is a bit. I mean, not a real issue, but like, let's just remember some stuff. Like, Bosnians don't love Canadians. Italians love Canadians. Mm. Like, we, you know, Bosnians still remember that we were part of that NATO mission to restore peace, justice, and order in the Balkans, and they bore the brunt of the bombing. And I mean, we didn't really do much of the bombing, but we still did, you know, we participated in it in some way or another. Like, it's true, Bosnians actually don't like Canadians. Like, that's just gonna be a heated hot game. Not that it matters, but if we played Italy, there'd be all like hugs and cuddles after the game. Now there's gonna be like stiff handshakes, which it's fine, it's less pleasant to watch.
Yeah, no, might be more aggressive though, and that's always, it's always better when it comes to the World Cup. But yeah, that's all we've got time for today. Thank you for joining us on the Plugged in My Ears podcast. We will see you next week.
On Saturday, May 2nd at 6 p.m., the Food Sharing Project invites you to step into a lively, chef-powered dining experience unlike any other. Start the night with a complimentary cocktail, raw bar,